Hello, everyone. Welcome to the sixth and final lecture being given by the Slade Professor of Fine Art for 2021. As some of you will know, these lectures are an important tradition at the University of Oxford. John Ruskin was the first to give a series of public lectures on art in 1870, after being appointed as the initial Slade Professor of Fine Art. Every year, a distinguished scholar is asked to follow in his footsteps. My name is Geoffrey Batchin, and I am Professor of the History of Art at the University of Oxford. It is my great pleasure to introduce this year's Slade Professor, Dr. Geraldine D. Dodds. Jerry Dodds is Harlequin Adair Darman Professor, Faculty of Art History at Sarah Lawrence College in the United States. Professor Dodds' scholarly work has centered on medieval Spanish art and architecture, and especially on issues of transculturation and identity formation. Among her many publications are Arts of Intimacy, Christians, Jews, and Muslims in the Making of Castilian Culture, a renowned co-authored textbook. In addition to her other books, catalogues, and essays, Jerry has also curated a number of important exhibitions and made interesting films to accompany them. In 2018, in recognition of her exceptional contributions to the dissemination of knowledge of Spanish history and culture, Professor Dodds was the recipient of the Cross of the Order of Civil Merit from the Government of Spain. We are honored that Professor Dodds accepted our invitation to deliver this year's Slade Professor of Fine Art lectures, and I now hand over the microphone to her for the last time. Thank you.
Thank you so much again, Professor Batchin. I'll have more to say at the end, but thank you for your very generous words. So the Alhambra in Granada, the great palace of the Nasrid monarchy, has been gloriously ornamented over times with scores of our own projected meanings. Washington Irving, my countryman, who wrote from a set of apartments he had procured within the very Alhambra in the spring of 1829, called it an Oriental pile, the royal abode of the Moorish kings where, surrounded with the splendors and refinements of Asiatic luxury, they made their last stand for empire in Spain. Looking back, I believe that despite our ardent intellectual fealty to Edward Said, we were not so long ago moved to say similar things, if in more guarded language. And why not? Asiatic and Oriental aside, of course, this was a building constructed to quicken the hearts of those who beheld it from within and without. Our mistake is to see this in Irving's terms of only splendors and refinement, because the Alhambra was a far deeper game than that. The first Nasrid, Muhammad I, having defeated Ibn Hud of Murcia in the 13th century, cobbled together an Islamic polity, styling himself as the king of Iberian Muslims under the shelter of a feudal pact with Ferdinand III. The Nasrid dynasty was born then as a vassal of Castile, though not a consistently compliant one. After first settling on the hill of the Albaicin, he's said to have climbed to the more formidable Sabica Hill and laid out a stronghold, which would become a fortress and a palatine city. The palace's relations to its dramatic setting, D. Fairchild Ruggles reminds us, would become not only a context, but a metaphor for territory and sovereignty for future Nasrid monarchs. And Muhammad was already keenly aware of his position, governing a condensed vestigial territory pushed hard against the Mediterranean. Here, he clearly declared his intention to imagine this rule as that of Al-Andalus writ large in the most perilous moment of its existence. It would be continuously expanded and transformed under successive Nasrid rulers, as Antonio Fernandez Puertas has shown us over the years. The monarch who is our focus, Muhammad V, made perhaps the most memorable changes to the Alhambra. We're going to join him in 1362, just returned from an exile of 3 years, to a throne that had been lost to his half-brother, a throne regained with the help of his great ally and feudal lord, Peter I, also called Peter the Cruel, King of Castile. Muhammad would continue to rule for almost 30 years more, in part because of his friendship with Peter and also his strategic management of that volatile and tortured Castilian king. Upon his return, Muhammad first renovated the Mexuar, where palace business was conducted, the Sala de la Barca, and the north gallery of the Casa del Sultan, called today Comares Palace, the center of court life. And around 1370, he then set out to add an entirely new complex to the palace, which we often call today the Palace of the Lions, known in the time of Muhammad V as Ar-Riyada Said, a garden of delights, a court divided into four parts by water channels that flowed to a central fountain circled by lions. On the east-west axis are pavilions resting on frail columns, and to the north-south, spectacular kubas, centrally planned rooms crowned with mukarnas, interlocking complexes of sections of cones, creating intricately complex sculptural surfaces, complicating but disconnected from the structure of an arch or dome. These domes have a kinetic effect established through their changing appearance as light rotated through a crown of pierced windows, revealing an intricate, continuously rotating vault of heaven as the sun marks its passage through the skies. Surfaces of ataurique, continuous floral and vine scrolls, are complexly conceived and often interwoven with epigraphy. Over 3,000 inscriptions, including the Nasrid motto, prayers, maxims, and some 30 poems or poetic fragments written expressly for the palace by Ibn al-Hayyab, Ibn Zamrak, and Ibn al-Khatib, poets and elite Nasrid courtiers at the moment of the palace's construction, and studied today in profoundly important work by José Miguel Puerta Vilches, who calls the Alhambra a literary, textual building. In fact, one's entitlement within its walls was intertwined with one's ability to read the building and interact appropriately with its compact cursive epigraphy floating on top of fields of ataurique. The effect is one of two independent but intertwining abstract discourses in which the epigraphic one is certainly dominant. Work on the Alhambra during the past decades has revealed much about its complex ornamental discourses, in particular as regards the language with which the building itself admonishes the viewer in the first person to slow their pace and engage. A poem from the Kalahura of Muhammad VII declares, "You who enter, stop, for God's sake, contemplate." This occurs for Olga Bush in a framing of aesthetic experience as the arrested movement of ceremonial ritual, artistic preparation for the veneration of the Sultan. The building is thus interpretively dense and multivalent. Juan Carlos Ruiz reads a vision dedicated to creation and eternity, and he urges us to draw on Yasser Tawa's theory of the Mukarnas Dome as an expression of an atomic rather than Aristotelian view of the universe, one made of intricate fragments that only God can know or govern. Olga Bush has shown a meticulously conceived program in which ornament interacts in concert with textiles and furnishings, which in turn share a dialogic structure with poetry, so that those same fine textiles and luxurious objects that Washington Irving imagined emerge as part of a learned, intellectualized court culture that the charming 19th century enthusiast could not begin to imagine. Indeed, for Cynthia Robinson, the language of forms is a dense allegorical web, profoundly informed by Sufism, that consciously plays with the concepts of mimesis and representation, both abstract and literal, through ornament, poetry, and epigraphy. So, how are we to understand these monumental figural paintings in the Garden of Delights? A group of gentlemen against the gold ground, and images of courtly romances, hunting, and valor of arms painted in opaque, saturated tempera. The Court of the Lions, Ar-Riyada Said, has been seen literally for centuries as duplicating the functions of the Palace of Comares, or perhaps as a summer pleasure palace, or as a banquet hall, as some still see it today. It is on one hand a paradisical setting, but I'd like to talk about it today in terms offered to us by Juan Carlos Ruiz Sousa, who recognized that the court and its dependencies were reflective of a series of madrasas, sites of learning, constructed under the patronage of 14th century Marinid sultans that Muhammad might well have seen during his exile in North Africa. As scholars, we'd all been for so long so focused on the pleasure theory, like Irving, as good Orientalists, that we had not seen this clear form that we knew so well. The Court of the Lions is interpreted today by some as a Bayt al-Hikmah, a term that arose first in relationship to the library or house of wisdom of Baghdad in the late 8th and 9th centuries. But later examples were conceived as libraries, as sites for scholarly exchange and the education of princes. And you see here just such a library. You can see little books in the back with a group of wise people organizing their own discussion in a Makamat manuscript from around 1300. Susanna Calvo Capilla has shown how this kind of courtly institution, a library that becomes a place of learning and discussion, was already part of the dynastic strategies for legitimacy in Al-Andalus in the period of the Caliphate, when it appeared in the pillared hall of the Umayyad palace of Medina al-Zahra. Here, Roman sarcophagi of the philosopher type became both emblems of the intellectual activity that occurred there and allegories for the wise ancients whose classical texts were translated and studied there. They embody the process of translation as an arm of instruction, part of the incorporation of a body of knowledge into Umayyad legacy, as part of their legitimization and self-definition. A Bayt al-Hikmah at the Alhambra might be seen then not only as a place for the consideration of jurisprudence, but also the cultivation of ancient texts, philosophy, the sciences, and adab, that is secular literature, collective wisdom and virtues and codes of comportment that all princes ought to follow. The texts supporting this intellectual work at the Alhambra would have been contained in alcoves at the eastern extreme of the Palace of the Lions, farthest from the entrance, but opening onto a gallery and court, as at Medina al-Zahra. So the paintings are up here. These are the alcoves that one supposes the books would have been kept, and the paintings are tucked behind them here, one there, and one at the end. So then how do these paintings function within the palace and library, within the embrace of this highly intellectualized and esoteric language of ornament that characterizes Ar-Riyad al-Sa'id as a whole? These paintings are first provided with an epigraphic context. The actual poetry composed to celebrate Muhammad V is concentrated on the north-south axis of the palace, defined by the two kubas and likely a throne complex. The inscriptions from the other parts of the Palace of the Lion tend to repeat phrases and prayers found throughout the building, the Nasrid motto, "There is no victor but God," and others, "Blessing, good fortune, everlasting health, glory be to our Lord the Sultan," short mottos that might have served as aide-mémoire for longer formulae within the official protocol, as Jeremy Johns has suggested, for Sicily. But in the east-west axis, culminating just in front of the hall where the paintings are located, the language of the inscription militates. Certain formulae are concentrated in front of the paintings. Muhammad is not just our Lord, but just warrior, which does not appear on any of the other faces of the courtyard facade. Epigraphy promises not just prosperity, but eternal sovereignty and dominion and clear victory. Texts that are formulaic, to be sure, but which congregate here. And a more elaborate formula is repeated twice in the monumental cursive inscriptions leading to the central painting, to wit, "Divide aid, dominion, and clear victory belong to our Lord Abdullah, Prince of the Muslims." On the other axis in the court, this only appears immediately in front of the throne room. The juxtaposition of expressive languages, one that hinges on intricate abstract and epigraphic semantic structures, and the monumental figuration of the other is jarring, the more so because the paintings are tucked high into these constricted spaces, so they cannot be seen until one's directly below them. The figural and narrative paintings on leather, executed probably between 1380 and 1390, seem in comparison almost primitively literal, a contrast that Robinson interestingly sees as part of a play of mimesis and representation throughout the palace. The center most of these paintings likely represents, Echevarria has suggested, an assembly of knights surrounding the sultan. Ibn Hudayl compared them to the Ansar, companions of the Prophet, one of a series of metaphors exploited by the Nasrids in the construction of a fictive identity of pure Arab genealogy, ancient lineage, and unquestioned religious orthodoxy in the pursuit of jihad as a struggle against the enemies of Islam. Years ago, I compared them to an illustration from a Syrian copy of the Mukhtar al-Hikam of 1306, in which seven sages, among them Homer, Aristotle, Alexander the Great, and Solon, hold animated discussions from their temporally divergent worlds. My concern at the time was to construct a precedence for the representation of an interaction across time, but the Mukhtar al-Hikam, the choicest maxims and aphorisms, makes sense now in a different way if we understand the ceiling as the covering of a library alcove. The illustration is, after all, made for a book that's a collection of, albeit dubious, biographies and aphorisms of great sages, whose discourse with one another only such a book makes possible. The illumination is, in one sense, a visualization of the translation of its compiler, Ibn Fatih, who brought these sages together from different times and places so that their wisdom could be discussed and compared by readers. The majlis, the gathering of elite masrids in the paintings, might evoke a similar conversation based on the books in the library below. Translation included commentary, interpretation, and new information. It favored contemporary contingencies over fidelity to a historical model. The learned elites in the central dome seem, in the time of the Nasrid Sultan, Muhammad V, or perhaps a few years after his death, to be echoing yet another act of translation through deliberation. But the discourse of the lateral cupolas to the north and south of this one is quite a different story. They depict, in a shallow space, a landscape or garden in which birds populate the trees and skies, hovering oddly over both compositions with ominous ubiquity, a setting that must represent Ar-Riyad al-Sa'id, the Garden of Delights, in which it is found. Chandler Post, pointing out Gallicisms in costumes, called the style Franco-Gothic. By the way, he also reported that Bernard Berenson assigned them to a Florentine master, something Post actually asked him to confirm in writing. I probably would too. Indeed, in terms of Gallicism, it shares certain conventions of representation with the Arturian wall paintings of the Chateau of Saint-Florent in Auvergne, but we're most likely looking at an Iberian tradition of secular painting. The same typologies can be found in the Cantigas and in 14th century miniatures of Alfonso XI's Cronica Troiana. Carmen Rayo Gross made this comparison of young knights. She believes the technique, tempera painting on a ground prepared with gesso, to be common with 14th century Christian altarpieces, but familiarity with a secular romance tradition of the kind encouraged under Alfonso XI, Peter I's father, seems a more likely place for this type to have been developed, especially in light of the lively artistic exchanges documented between the Castilian and Nasrid courts in the 14th century. But iconographically, things get more complicated. In my very first publication, now over 40 years ago, I suggested that the paintings in the Hall of the Kings of the Alhambra used Arturian iconography as part of a fashionable admiration in the Nasrid court for Gothic style and the language of chivalry, one in which that yearning was marked by the defiant, monumental, polarizing image of a Muslim killing a Christian knight in mounted combat. I saw the story of Tristan and Isolde, images of Lancelot and the wild man, as connected to Gothic prototypes, perhaps from French Gothic ivory caskets, known as composite caskets, that combine some of the same disconnected scene from disparate stories and legends as topoi of courtly love and moralized transgression. It seemed an okay bit of iconography for the time, but the terms in which I spoke feel scurrilous as I read them today, to wit, the idea of fashionable admiration linked with guileless misunderstanding, a patently Orientalist assumption which was seized upon 30 years later by Cynthia Robinson in a ground-changing volume she edited together with Simone Pinet, one that has very much transformed the way we think about these images. Robinson had shown that courtly tales could be found in this far more transcultural mix that we had not considered before. Tristan de Leonis, a version of Tristan and Isolde, and Flores and Blanca Flor, both Castilian transcultural narratives, very likely known by their Nasrid allies, are also present in the imagery of the paintings. So these images were not misunderstandings. They were, as Rodriguez Porto suggested, translations, appropriations, inventions, and refashionings to serve an already transcultural repertory. A slightly more complacent lady with wild man can be found, for instance, as an isolated image in the castle of Alcañiz, and its myriad meanings, iconographical and iconological and psychological, are all available, Pinet tells us, in the Dar al-Hikma. The idea of translation becomes particularly interesting if we reconsider a key image from my original study. Tristan and his love meet in both French and Castilian recensions of the story in a set piece called The Tryst Beneath the Tree, here in an iconographical type widely disseminated in courtly arts. But within the fountain are a series of nude figures, and I don't know if you can see them. They're here, and this is a closer photograph made of them. You can see these nude figures who are within the fountain. Now, the nude figures correspond to a type for nude figures bathing in the fountain of youth, a scene probably from the Alexander cycle, which also appears separately, together with the tryst, on the composite caskets. Only usually they get their own fountain. Actually, always they get their own fountain. I'd originally called this a misunderstanding of the Gothic type, measuring its validity by conformity to an authoritative original, and protecting onto the Nasrids, and I use here the words of Barry Flood in speaking of Hindu-Muslim encounters, projecting onto the Nasrids a backward-oriented and ideologically charged source-mongering. I had to give that quote because I love the source-mongering part. It's clear here that the iconographical type was available to the artists of the Alhambra paintings, but not thematically compelling. So these pesky nude figures were redeployed. Robinson saw them as part of a fountain, and I wonder if perhaps they're reconceived as a piece of classical spolia within a fountain, an image of a kind that was consistently part of the translative culture of Islamic Iberia for all 7 centuries of its existence. Recall that a Roman sculpture of Venus graced the southern gateway to Medina al-Zahra, which was translated into an allegory for the planet Venus, or the constellation Virgo, stars that protected al-Andalus, or the classical sarcophagi found in the Bayt al-Hikma of Medina al-Zahra, transformed into the concept of the wise ancients whose work was studied there. In this Dar al-Hikma, the images from Tristan or Flor and Blanca Flor are from romances, cycles of courtly love that are often juxtaposed in a French Gothic context as topoi of courtly love and moralized transgression. But here they're translated to serve a divergent moral code, something accomplished as these romances are semantically girded by a series of dynamic scenes in a more monumental scale as a guiding moral discourse in the painting cycle. The most salient image of the cycle is a single joust in which a Muslim kills a Christian knight, and Robinson has also connected this to one of the romances. It governs the interpretation of the other vignettes, placing ascendancy with Muslim Nights in the context of these transcultural narratives. Beyond the particular romance narrative, it is structurally central to the discourse of the painting. It really is emblematic, not of Nasrid or Castilian or Gothic chivalry, as we often try to nuance things. Here, I think it's really an image of a Christian and a Muslim in an uncomplicated bipolar opposition. The transcultural space of the Garden of Delights is confessionally contested territory. Such images of hunting and violence, beyond the narratives to which they might be attached, constitute a separate discourse of easily readable analogies within the paintings. The Christian knight is to the wild man whom he kills, as the Muslim knight is to the Christian he defeats. At the Alhambra, these more monumental images corral the romance vignettes, acting sort of as moral sentries to their transcultural stories that claim romance literature in the library below as part of a common culture. In this way, they proclaim that the textual incorporation of this literature does not extend to confessional ambivalence or to Nasrid identity. Recent studies by Mohammed Balan have revealed in the work of the Nasrid dynasty's extraordinary polymath and courtier Ibn al-Khatib a genealogical obsession with a myth of pure Arab descent and unsullied Muslim confession and lineage that masked genealogical anxieties about pure identity that stemmed from the very heterogeneous descent of the Nasrid themselves, both because of the demographics of their plural polity and because of their own lineage. And on the simplest level, very much like much of his line, Muhammad V's mother, Buthania, was a Christian. And this also acts in a way to obscure their political interdependence on the Kingdom of Castile. For the Nasrid Kingdom of Granada still danced a tenuous diplomacy as both the last connection of the Marinid states of North Africa to the Iberian Peninsula and as vassals of Castile, for whom they acted as a bulwark against the same polity. Granada and Castile were interwoven not only through tribute and military obligations, but also through agriculture, the Nasrid's powerful international trade networks, and the lively artistic interaction that saw not only a market in objects and materials, but the movement of artistic styles from Granada to Seville, and then back to Granada again, after Peter I received Muhammad V during his exile and returned him to his throne. So there was tension within this transcultural garden of chivalry. The remaining images of this second, more agonistic discourse in the paintings are all hunters, but they exist in a garden already full of hunting. Figures wind hunting horns, attendants heft spears, dogs course beneath horses' hooves and attack the hunter's prey. In a way, everyone hunts, so that the very skies are filled with hunters. Falcons snatch doves in flight, extending their talons and beaks in midair. In the southern ceiling, we see established in an unusually clear and graphic compositional juxtaposition the metaphoric relationship between hunting and warfare. Hunting not only as preparation, training for the skills of warfare. By the way, hunting, said Castilian King Alfonso XI, Peter's father, is good preparation for war and also quite a bit less expensive. Not only preparation for war, but hunting as an aristocratic activity that has the capacity of mirroring the hierarchies inherent in feudal warfare and society. A Muslim spearing a boar and a Christian who spears a bear face one another on either side of Tristan and Isolde's fateful tryst. Their costumes that relate them to figures in the romance narrative scenes have prompted suggestions of Castilians and Nasrids engaging in common chivalrous activities. And indeed, they point us to a particular culturally determined kind of hunting in Castile. Hunting, King Alfonso X once intoned, always belongs to kings. That was in his Libro de las Animalias que Cazan, in turn a translation of an Arabic text today called Mu'amin. This idea, reflecting the contentions on both sides of the confessional divide, was refined by texts of Alfonso's nephew, Juan Manuel, in his Libro de la Caza, which favors falconry as the most subtle kind of hunting, in which a raptor is trained to pursue game that are not its natural quarry. Falconing had been a part of the earliest Umayyad traditions in Syria, and in Al-Andalus became emblematic of Umayyad sovereignty for the first 300 years of its history. Makariu noted syncretism between the falcon and Umayyad power in both poetry and art during the entire caliphate. And falconry imagery continued in the Taifa palace of Al-Mahmun in Toledo as a more general signifier of terrestrial hegemony. Ibn Hudayl, whose Nasrid treatise on chivalry were dedicated to Muhammad V and Muhammad VII, privileges falconing among all those forms of hunt. It was practiced by all the great Nasrid rulers and lords, he recounts, who kept teams of falconers. Falconers were the most prized gift. Falcons were the most prized gifts exchanged between rulers, and he characterizes falconry as the quintessential Arab practice, one honored throughout Islam, marking it for particular importance in the formation of Nasrid identity. But remarkably, though there are raptors in the air, the only person to hunt a bird of prey in the Alhambra is a lady, on whose wrist a very diminutive merlin perches. Suggesting predatory credentials, her champion seems to lack. So the monumental hunters in the Alhambra paintings do not engage in the kind of hunting that one would imagine they might, in their careful construction of the Nasrid's adherence to a blemishless Arab and Muslim genealogy. I think the reason is this. What is represented in the paintings was instead the kind of hunting that was explicitly connected to Alfonso XI and his son Pedro I, the Castilians with whom these Nasrids were culturally and politically entangled. Jonathan Bourgogne has shown that Caza Mayor, hunting large game on horseback with dogs, the hunt as it is shown in the Alhambra paintings, articulated an ideological position for Alfonso XI in his Libro de la Montería, the Book of Mounted Hunting, a position opposed to falconry in a ritual opposition to his enemy Juan Manuel, who promoted falconry in the Libro de la Caza. Ibn Zamrak, so many of whose poems compose the Alhambra's epigraphic discourse, wrote a hunting poem describing Muhammad V's particular passion for the hunt. These images were then not completely emblematic, for though falconry was the most esteemed of practices, the Nasrids also practiced Caza Mayor. The animals hunted in the Alhambra paintings are not only the large games reserved for nobility and royalty and Castilian practice, they are also the actual quarry of the mountains surrounding Granada, bears, wild boar, and deer. So here in the Alhambra, the Nasrids are laying aside their concern with their iconic Arab past and are choosing instead to take on the Castilians in their own ideological and, as it turns out, topographical terrain. For Alfonso XI's Libro de la Montería conveys, Senef positive, a clearly defined ideology of the authority of the monarch and nobility in the 1330s and 40s. In part, he says, because it includes a charting of all the hunting lands in the Kingdom of Castile, 1,500 areas encompassing 9,000 locations for Caza Mayor, mounted hunting. It is, in fact, the first comprehensive toponymic survey produced in Castile. Because hunting large game on horseback with dogs was a privilege of the king, one that performed his possession of the land, a privilege he could bestow or withhold. The survey of hunting lands became one means of defining the topography of his sovereignty. And so one level of the tension hovering like so many hawks over the garden of Al-Rayyad Al-Sayyid is to be explained by the simple fact that the hunting lands of the King of Castile included not only Burgos, Soria, Toledo, and Murcia, but also the hills of the Nasrid Kingdom of Granada. So we might see the hunters, like the jousting pairs, as sentinels, perhaps vigilantes, meant to patrol the semantic frontiers of the ceiling. This is expressed, without the subtle nuance of the Alhambra's epigraphic program, as the same hunters prepare to present their quarry to ladies. and I'm going to show you the drawings, which are a little clearer. A Muslim presents his quarry in an erect posture, while the Castilian offers his in a kneeling position, marking him as a supplicant in the tradition of courtly love. And while the Muslim's lady leans forward and points to the quarry in approbation, the Christian's lady recoils slightly in ambivalence. The Christian is a rather overt foil to the erect Muslim, comparatively impotent and lacking in dignity, as the conventions of courtly love are turned against him in an image meant to ridicule an aspect of courtly culture that mimics feudal practice, the aristocratic lady in the role of the feudal master of her effective vassal. This position is echoed in an image of a page who kneels before King Alfonso XI in an illustrated copy of his own hunting book, the Libro de la Montería, completed by his son. Here, the page offers the king quarry from the hunt for his meal in a less metaphorical image of vassalage. This type, then, is used to invert the political dilemma of the Nasrids in the Alhambra painting. And it was a type they surely knew. Images of the feudal subjugation of Muslims were not unusual in Castilian courts. They're repeatedly depicted in the pages of the Cantigas de Santa Maria, which might well have been in that library below. So the paintings of the Palace of the Lions, on one hand, must constitute a response by the Nasrids to their own political and psychic vassalage, the contingency of their possession of their own lands, their own reluctance to play the subaltern. I'm wondering if the whole complex, multi-layered composition is not only an image of a shared romance and activities, but also a figural translation of the militant models that announced the paintings: just warrior, eternal sovereignty, dominion, victory, and divine aid, dominion, and clear victory belong to our Lord. In a composition that presented both a dominant and a background discourse, just as the epigraphic panels do. Ibn Khaldun, who came to Granada on an embassy to Pedro I of Castile, had remarked disapprovingly that the Nasrid made figural art, although it's unlikely that he saw the paintings that we're talking about today. He might have been thinking of wall paintings like these earlier ones from the Partal, when he said, "The Nasrids even draw pictures on the walls and have them in buildings and houses." The intelligent observer will draw from this the conclusion that it is a sign of being dominated by others. Perhaps we might see these paintings as a defiant response in the midst of a building that otherwise musters all the possibilities of erudite and iconic expression to the kind of attitude voiced by Ibn Khaldun. Not so much his disapproval of their figural arts as to his contention that cultural reception is a mark of weakness. The paintings might be, in fact, the Nasrids' declaration of their capacity to master and manipulate figural styles, to translate ideas like dominion, victory, and jihad from Arabic epigraphy into the Castilian's own figural language of expression, to possess that language as well, to serve a different concept of chivalry than that presented in Castilian texts. Alfonso XI had established his new secular chivalrous order, the Order of the Band, which supplanted monastic military orders, in particular that of the Templars, much to the anguish of the Pope. The objectives of the new order were limited to promoting chivalry and loyalty to the king, with few religious obligations. There was, our very lamented Peter Linehan remarked, more of the round table than the Last Supper in Alfonso's new order. Rodriguez Porto sees Alfonso XI as promoting courtly literature with a special interest in the secular side of these narratives, both French and Iberian, in her words, elevating chivalry to a regulating code of courtly life and making the court a place of pleasure and refinement that escaped the church's control. And this image that you see here on the right is actually in the paintings of the paintings that we're looking at, but the contention now is that it was painted there much later. And certainly, there were Muslims in Nasrid times who lived this, who lived the idea of the Order of the Band. That's been pointed out before. Hundreds of Muslim knights who fought for Pedro of Castile in Teruel were awarded the Order of the Band, as it has been suggested that it was present in the Alhambra as well. However, the Alhambra paintings are governed by a different series of ideas about what chivalry is. The works by Ibn Hudayl had as their subject a Nasrid view of chivalry, combining not only horsemanship, but military skills in hunting with a pronounced ideological bent. His work Ornament of the Souls and Arms of the Inhabitants of Al-Andalus, written under Muhammad V, was seen by Alejandro Garcia San Juan as a genre of jihad literature. To reinvigorate jihad, the author declares, God has given the Sultan for teaching the war against the infidel, and significantly, assisted by God, he will liberate this country from the bonds that keep it in inferiority, will bring abundance after sterility, free these lands from the fist of consumption. Jihad, Abigail Balbale has shown, was a uniquely labile tool for simultaneously legitimating authority and undermining enemies of any religion. Indeed, the fissure between ideal and execution was wide. Hussein Fancy has shown Christian and Muslim rulers regularly deploying multi-confessional armies and mercenaries to achieve political goals in the name of holy war, of both crusade and jihad. For Ibn Hudayl, scars to a fragile Nasrid identity might well have been inflicted by the contingencies of a Muhammad V's subtle Castilian diplomacy until the death of Peter I. His text hovers like the hawks in fountains over the dignified hunters and submitted Christians of the Hall of Justice ceilings. His raw exhortation to liberate his country from the bonds that keep it in inferiority is a call to erase an apparent shame, voiced coldly by Ibn Khaldun. Quote, the Spaniards assimilate themselves to the Christian nation in their dress, their emblems, and most of their customs and traditions. An indication, he says, that the vanquished can always be observed to assimilate themselves to the victor. Garcia San Juan sees an oblique reference in Ornament to the Nasrid's one great 14th century victory against the Christians, Muhammad V's victory at Algeciras, conquered only months after the death of Peter I, with its consequent dissolution of those feudal obligations. And this confluence of ideas is, of course, central to the Alhambra, which Oleg Grabar saw long ago as a victory monument to that single battle, celebrated in a poem by Ibn Zamrak in the Sala de la Barca. How many infidels did you reach in the morning, only to become the arbiter of their lives in the evening? You put on them the yoke of captives, so that they appear at your doorstep to build palaces in servitude. You conquered Algeciras by the sword, and opened the gate which had until then been denied to our victory. Or, on the Fountain of the Lions, on a direct axis with the paintings, its lions are identified as Ust al-Jihad, the lions of war. These paintings are dedicated, as one of their meanings, to the Sultan's renewal of jihad in an age of ambivalent alliances, defying a perception that Iberian Muslims were too entangled and complacent. One of the titles conferred on Muhammad V was Al-Mujahid, the Holy Warrior. Perhaps these paintings fashion Nasrid chivalry as an expression of the exaltation of jihad in the face of tangled cultures and alliances. Writing at a time before the paintings, Ibn Khaldun presented the Nasrid's penchant for figuration as a state of weakness, as a tradition to be conquered. But at the Alhambra, resistance was useless, so it must needs be conquered from within, the excision of the Christian from within, in Simon Pinet's words. Far from misunderstanding their models, the Nasrids met the Castilians on their own formal grounds in the paintings of the Dar al-Hikmah, showing mastery of both artistic languages, both concepts of chivalry and both languages of the hunt, marking out the territory of the garden, the library, and the realm with a dream of jihad, of a separateness they could not achieve. It is a sacred language of expression at the intersection of profound transculturation and the deep desire to individuate. The paintings decode in Samia Mehra's words regarding translation, a referential world in which more than one language is involved, one in which images are suspended in the complexities of multi-layered cultural content. But then, was Ibn Khaldun correct? Is transculturation the domain of the vanquished? By now that ought to be received, I hope, as a rhetorical question. Consider these two images of hunters. Both depict courtly aristocrats. Both are hunting bears, one painted in saturated tempera over a leather vault against a backdrop of verdant woods, and the other static and emblematic, inserted into a web of epigraphy, Mukarnas and Ataurike. They present us with the identical subject, chivalrously conceived in divergent artistic languages, almost contemporary to one another. The painted hunter against the verdant ground, well, you know it well enough by now. And as you've probably guessed, the stucco cartouche is from the palace of Peter I in Seville, the Alcázar, inserted into the precincts of an appropriated Almohad residence by his father, Alfonso XI, and himself. These hunting images from a Castilian palace in Seville are announced with an Arabic inscription that describes Pedro of Castile as Sultan, and in the same kind of cosmic terms that evoke Muhammad V in the Kubas of the Palace of the Lions of the Alhambra. They are embraced by Mukarnas, an Arabic and pseudo-Arabic epigraphy. In a tangle of exchanges and sharings, this language of expression, as Juan Carlos Ruiz Sosa has taught us, had become something like an official Castilian style, absorbing forms, but only those that marked, but only those meanings that marked his own interests and needs. The Nasrid panegyric of cosmic kingship as a stepping stone towards the formation of a centralized Castilian state. The unquestioned kingship performed by Nasrid rulers in the planning and epigraphy of the Alhambra was a very useful image for a monarch like Peter, whose power was dangerously contingent, was shared contentiously and in the end fatally with the lords of his realm. But transculturation is always multidirectional. The difference here is that, unlike the paintings of the Alhambra, the imagery is not coded for defiance or religious difference. This is because in this translation, the ultimate model, the Nasrid stucco styles of the Alhambra, is already deemed to be a part of the crown of Castile. By the end of the 15th century, the vestiges of the Nasrid kingdom presented to the Nesset Castilian and Aragonese alliance, an arena where a battle could be joined for the purpose of uniting a still divided Christian Iberia into a Catholic kingdom of Spain. If we see Al-Andalus as a cultural conduit of translated texts and of the arts and science to Spain or to a fictive West, we miss the point entirely. The struggle was not about how to exchange or appropriate. It was, at this point, how to disentangle. About the time I wrote my first article regarding the Alhambra paintings, George Steiner wrote of translation in his After Babel in this way. To experience difference, to feel the characteristic resistance and materiality of that which differs, is to re-experience identity. One's own space is mapped by what lies outside. It derives coherent, tactile configuration from the presence of the external. But now, many of the struggles I've tried to highlight here have been about something else. They've been about what happens when you can no longer clearly map the external as being outside, no longer feel sufficiently the characteristic resistance and materiality of that which differs. That question so much at the heart of the dilemma of the Nasrids also, for me, fuels the thrilling practice of the study of medieval Iberia. I'm not gone yet. Thank you so much for these weeks together. My thanks once again to the Slade Committee for the enormous honor conferred upon me in entrusting me with these lectures. I wish in particular to offer my thanks to Professor Jeffrey Batchen for his patience, care, and humor throughout the constantly changing terrain of this lecture series. To thank Professor Gervaise Rosser for his sage guidance and abiding support. And Holly Knights, Liz Green, and the entire Torch team for their incredible professionalism and endless patience. It has been such a gift that, though I have not been able to come to Oxford, Oxford has met me in a sort of virtual Dar al-Hikma, someplace over the Atlantic, together with all of the generous, brilliant international community of Hispanists, medievalists, and Islamicists who have been my correspondents, and in so many ways my teachers during the past year. My deepest thanks to you all.